full of the sound of crinkling and ripping. "How do you guys like it here so far?" she asks us. "It's been an adjustment," I say.
"Yeah, I know what you mean,"
Nita smiles at me. "I came from one of the other experiments, the one in Indianapolis, the one that failed."
"Oh, you don't know where Indianapolis is, do you?"
"It's not far from here, less than an hour by plane." She pauses.
"That won't mean anything to you either."
"You know what? It's not important." She takes a syringe and needle from its plastic paper wrapping, and Triss tenses.
"What's that for?"
Triss says. "It's what will enable us to read your genes," Matthew says. "Are you okay?"
"Yeah," Triss says, but she's still tense. "I just don't like to be injected with strange substances."
Matthew nods. "I swear it's just going to read your genes. That's all it does. Nita can vouch for it." Nita nods.
"Okay," Triss says, "but can I do it to myself?"
"Sure," Nita says. She prepares the syringe, filling it with whatever they intend to inject us with, and offers it to Triss.
"I'll give you the simplified explanation of how this works," Matthew says as Nita brushes Triss's arm with antiseptic.
The smell is sour, and it nips at the inside of my nose.
"The fluid is packed with microcomputers. They are designed to detect specific genetic markers and transmit the data to a computer. It will take them about an hour to give me as much information as I need, though it would take them much longer to read all your genetic material, obviously."
Triss sticks the needle into her arm and presses the plunger. Nita beckons my arm forward and drags the orange-stained gauze over my skin. The fluid in the syringe is silver-gray like fish scales, and it flows into me through the needle. I imagine the microscopic technology chewing through my body, reading me and analyzing me. Beside me, Triss holds a cotton ball to her pricked skin and offers me a small smile.
"What are the microcomputers?" Matthew nods, and I continue. "What are they looking for, exactly?"
"Well, when our predecessors at the Bureau inserted corrected genes into your ancestors, they also included a genetic tracker, which is basically something that shows us that a person has achieved genetic healing. In this case, the genetic tracker is awareness during simulations. It's something we can easily test for, which shows us if your genes are healed or not. That's one of the reasons why everyone in the city has to take the aptitude test at 16. If they're aware during the test, that shows us they might have healed genes." I add the aptitude test to a mental list of things that were once so important to me, cast aside because it was just a ruse to get these people the information or result they wanted. I can't believe that awareness during simulations, something that made me feel powerful and unique, something Janine and the erudite killed people for, is actually just a sign of genetic healing to these people. Like a special code word, telling them I'm in their genetically healed society. Matthew continues. "The only problem with the genetic tracker is that being aware during simulations and resisting serums doesn't necessarily mean that a person is divergent. It's just a strong correlation. Sometimes people will be aware during simulations or be able to resist serums even if they still have damaged genes." He shrugs. "That's why I'm interested in your genes, Tobias. I'm curious to see if you're actually divergent or if your simulation awareness just makes it look like you are." Nita, who is clearing the counter, presses her lips together like she is holding words inside her mouth. I feel suddenly uneasy. There's a chance I'm not actually divergent? "All that's left is to sit and wait," Matthew says. "I'm going to go get breakfast. Do either of you want something to eat?" Triss and I both shake our heads. "I'll be back soon, Nita. Keep them company, would you?" Matthew leaves without waiting for Nita's response, and Triss sits on the examination table, the paper crinkling beneath her and tearing where her leg hangs over the edge. Nita puts her hands in her jumpsuit pockets and looks at us. Her eyes are dark, with the same sheen as a puddle of oil beneath a leaking engine. She hands me a cotton ball, and I press it to the bubble of blood inside my elbow.
"So you came from a city experiment," says Triss. "How long have you been here?"
"Since the Indianapolis experiment was disbanded, which was about 8 years ago. I could have integrated into the greater population outside the experiments, but that felt too overwhelming." Nita leans against the counter,
So I volunteered to come here. I used to be a janitor. I'm moving through the ranks, I guess. She says it with a certain amount of bitterness. I suspect that here, as in Dauntless, there is a limit to her climb through the ranks, and she is reaching it earlier than she would like to, the same way I did when I chose my job in the control room. And your city, it didn't have factions? Triss says. No, it was the control group. It helped them to figure out that the factions were actually effective by comparison. It had a lot of rules, though. Curfew, wake-up times, safety regulations, no weapons allowed, stuff like that. What happened, I say, and a moment later I wish I hadn't asked because the corners of Nita's mouth turn down like the memory hangs heavy from each side. Well, a few of the people inside still knew how to make weapons. They made a bomb, you know, an explosive, and set it off in the government building, she says. Lots of people died. And after that, the Bureau decided our experiment was a failure. They erased the memories of the bombers and relocated the rest of us. I'm one of the only ones who wanted to come here. I'm sorry, Triss says softly. Sometimes I still forget to look for the gentler parts of her. For so long, all I saw was the strength, standing out like the wiry muscles in her arms or the black ink marking her collarbone with flight. It's all right. It's not like you guys don't know about stuff like this, says Nita, with what Janine Matthews did and all. Why haven't they shut our city down, Triss says, the same way they did to yours? They might still shut it down, says Nita. But I think the Chicago experiment, in particular, has been a success for so long that they'll be a little reluctant to just ditch it now. It was the first one with factions. I take the cotton ball away from my arm. There's a tiny red dot where the needle went in, but it isn't bleeding anymore. I like to think I would have chosen Dauntless, says Nita. But I don't think I would have had the stomach for it. You'd be surprised what you have the stomach for when you have to, Triss says. I feel a pang in the middle of my chest. She's right. Desperation can make a person do surprising things. We would both know. Matthew returns right at the hour mark, and he sits at the computer for a long time after that, his eyes flicking back and forth as he reads the screen. A few times he makes a revelatory noise, a hmm, or an ah. The longer he waits to tell us something, anything, the more tense my muscles become, until my shoulders feel like they are made of stone instead of flesh. Finally, he looks up and turns the screen around so we can see what's on it. This program helps us to interpret the data in an understandable way. What you see here is a simplified depiction of a particular DNA sequence in Triss's genetic material, he says. The picture on the screen is a complicated mass of lines and numbers, with certain parts selected in yellow and red. I can't make any sense of the picture beyond that. It is above my level of comprehension. These selections here suggest healed genes. We wouldn't see them if the genes were damaged. He taps certain parts of the screen. I don't understand what he's pointing at, but he doesn't seem to notice, caught up in his own explanation. These selections over here indicate that the program also found the genetic tracker, the simulation awareness. The combination of healed genes and simulation awareness genes is just what I expected to see from a divergent. Now, this is the strange part. He touches the screen again, and the screen changes, but it remains just as confusing. A web of lines, tangled threads of numbers. This is the map of Tobias's genes, Matthew says. As you can see, he has the right genetic components for simulation awareness, but he doesn't have the same healed genes that Triss does. My throat is dry, and I feel like I've been given bad news, but I still haven't entirely grasped what the bad news is. What does that mean? I ask. It means, Matthew says, that you are not divergent. Your genes are still damaged, but you have a genetic anomaly that allows you to be aware during simulations anyway. You have, in other words, the appearance of a divergent without actually being one. I process the information slowly, piece by piece. I'm not divergent. I'm not like Triss. I'm genetically damaged. The word damaged sinks inside me like it's made of lead. I guess I always knew there was something wrong with me, but I thought it was because of my father or my mother, and the pain they bequeathed to me like a family heirloom, handed down from generation to generation. And this means that the one good thing my father had, his divergence, didn't reach me. I don't look at Triss. I can't bear it. Instead, I look at Nita. Her expression is hard, almost angry. "Matthew," she says, "don't you want to take this data to your lab to analyze?" "Well, I was planning on discussing it with our subjects here," Matthew says. "I don't think that's a good idea," Triss says, sharp as a blade. Matthew says something I don't really hear. I'm listening to the thump of my heart. He taps the screen again and the picture of my DNA disappears, so the screen is blank. Just glass. He leaves, instructing us to visit his lab if we want more information. And Triss, Nita, and I stand in the room in silence. "It's not that big a deal," Triss says firmly. "Okay?" "You don't get to tell me it's not a big deal," I say, louder than I meant to be. Nita busies herself at the counter, making sure the containers are lined up, though they haven't moved since we first came in. "Yeah, I do," Triss exclaims. "You're the same person you were 5 minutes ago, and 4 months ago, and 18 years ago. This doesn't change anything about you." I hear something in her words that's right, but it's hard to believe her right now. "So you're telling me this affects nothing," I say. "The truth affects nothing." "What truth?" she says. "These people tell you there's something wrong with your genes and you just believe it?" "It was right there," I gesture to the screen. "You saw it." "I also see you," she says fiercely, her hand closing around my arm. "And I know who you are." I shake my head. I still can't look at her. Can't look at anything in particular. "I need to take a walk. I'll see you later." "Tobias, wait." I walk out and some of the pressure inside me releases as soon as I'm not in that room anymore. I walk down the cramped hallway that presses against me like an exhale and into the sunlit halls beyond it. The sky is bright blue now. I hear footsteps behind me, but they're too heavy to belong to Triss. "Hey." Nita twists her foot, making it squeak against the tile. "No pressure, but I'd like to talk to you about all this genetic damage stuff. If you're interested, meet me here tonight at 9. And no offense to your girl or anything, but you might not want to bring her." "Why?" I say. "She's a GP, genetically pure, so she can't understand that... Well, it's hard to explain. Just trust me, okay? She's better off staying away for a little while." "Okay." "Okay," Nita nods. "Gotta go." I watch her run back toward the gene therapy room, and then I keep walking. I don't know where I'm going exactly, just that when I walk, the frenzy of information I've learned in the past day stops moving quite so fast, stops shouting quite so loud inside my head.
Chapter 19. Triss. I don't go after him, because I don't know what to say. When I found out I was divergent, I thought of it as a secret power that no one else possessed, something that made me different, better, stronger. Now, after comparing my DNA to Tobias's on a computer screen, I realize that divergent doesn't mean as much as I thought it did. It's just a word for a particular sequence in my DNA, like a word for all people with brown eyes or blonde hair. I lean my head into my hands. But these people still think it means something. They still think it means I'm healed in a way that Tobias is not. And they want me to just trust that. Believe it. Well, I don't. And I'm not sure why Tobias does. Why he's so eager to believe that he is damaged. I don't want to think about it anymore. I leave the gene therapy room just as Nita is walking back to it. "What did you say to him?" I say. She's pretty. Tall but not too tall. Thin but not too thin. Her skin rich with color. "I just made sure he knew where he was going," she says. "It's a confusing place." It certainly is. I start toward, well, I don't know where I'm going, but it's away from Nita, the pretty girl who talks to my boyfriend when I'm not there. Then again, it's not like it was a long conversation. I spot Zoe at the end of the hallway, and she waves me toward her. She looks more relaxed now than she did earlier this morning. Her forehead smooth instead of creased, her hair loose over her shoulders. She shoves her hands into the pockets of her jumpsuit. I just told the others, she says. We've scheduled a plane ride in 2 hours for those who want to go. Are you up for it? Fear and excitement squirm together in my stomach, just like they did before I was strapped in on the zip line atop the Hancock building. I imagine hurtling into the air in a car with wings, the energy of the engine and the rush of wind through all the spaces in the walls, and the possibility, however slight, that something will fail, and I will plummet to my death. Yes, I say. We're meeting at gate B14. Follow the signs. She flashes a smile as she leaves. I look through the windows above me. The sky is clear and pale, the same color as my own eyes. There is a kind of inevitability in it, like it has always been waiting for me. Maybe because I relish height while others fear it, or maybe because once you have seen the things that I have seen, there is only one frontier left to explore, and it is above. The metal stairs leading down to the pavement screech with each of my footsteps. I have to tilt my head back to look at the airplane, which is bigger than I expected it to be, and silver white. Just below the wing is a huge cylinder with spinning blades inside it. I imagine the blades sucking me in and spitting me out the other side, and shudder a little. How can something that big stay in the sky? Uriah says from behind me. I shake my head. I don't know, and I don't want to think about it. I follow Zoe up another set of stairs, this one connected to a hole in the side of the plane. My hand shakes when I grab the railing, and I look over my shoulder one last time to check if Tobias caught up to us. He isn't there. I haven't seen him since the genetic test. I duck when I go through the hole, though it's taller than my head. Inside the airplane are rows and rows of seats, covered in ripped, fraying blue fabric. I choose one near the front, next to a window. A metal bar pushes against my spine. It feels like a chair skeleton, with barely any flesh to support it. Kara sits behind me, and Peter and Caleb move toward the back of the plane and sit near each other, next to the window. I didn't know they were friends. It seems fitting, given how despicable they both are. How old is this thing? I ask Zoe, who stands near the front. Pretty old, she says. But we've completely redone the important stuff. It's a nice size for what we need. What do you use it for? Surveillance missions, mostly. We like to keep an eye on what's happening in the fringe, in case it threatens what's happening in here. Zoe pauses. The fringe is a large, sort of chaotic place, between Chicago and the nearest government-regulated metropolitan area, Milwaukee, which is about a 3-hour drive from here. I would like to ask what exactly is happening in the fringe, but Uriah and Christina sit in the seats next to me, and the moment is lost. Uriah puts an armrest down between us and leans over me to look out the window. If the Dauntless knew about this, everyone would be getting in line to learn how to drive it, he says, including me. No, they would be strapping themselves to the wings, Christina pokes his arm. Don't you know your own faction? Uriah pokes her cheek in response, then turns back to the window again. Have either of you seen Tobias lately? I say. No, haven't seen him, Christina says. Everything okay? Before I can answer, an older woman with lines around her mouth stands in the aisle between the rows of seats and claps her hands. My name is Karen, and I'll be flying this plane today, she announces. It may seem frightening, but remember, the odds of us crashing are actually much lower than the odds of a car crash. So are the odds of survival if we do crash, Uriah mutters. But he's grinning. His dark eyes are alert, and he looks giddy, like a child. I haven't seen him this way since Marlene died. He's handsome again. Karen disappears into the front of the plane, and Zoe sits across the aisle from Christina, twisting around to call out instructions like, buckle your seatbelts, and don't stand up until we've reached our cruising altitude. I'm not sure what cruising altitude is, and she doesn't explain it, in true Zoe fashion. It was almost a miracle that she remembered to explain the fringe earlier. The plane starts to move backward, and I'm surprised by how smooth it feels, like we're already floating over the ground. Then it turns and glides over the pavement, which is painted with dozens of lines and symbols. My heart beats faster the farther we go away from the compound, and then Karen's voice speaks through an intercom. Prepare for takeoff. I clench the armrests as the plane lurches into motion. The momentum presses me back against the skeleton chair, and the view out the window turns into a smear of color. Then I feel it, the lift, the rising of the plane, and I see the ground stretching wide beneath us, everything getting smaller by the second. My mouth hangs open, and I forget to breathe. I see the compound, shaped like the picture of a neuron I once saw in my science textbook, and the fence that surrounds it. Around it is a web of concrete roads, with buildings sandwiched between them. And then suddenly, I can't even see the roads or the buildings anymore, because there is just a sheet of gray and green and brown beneath us, and farther than I can see in any direction is land, land, land. I don't know what I expected. To see the place where the world ends, like a giant cliff hanging in the sky? What I didn't expect is to know that I have been a person standing in a house that I can't even see from here. That I have walked a street among hundreds, thousands of other streets. What I didn't expect is to feel so, so small. We can't fly too high or too close to the city because we don't want to draw attention. So we'll observe from a great distance. Coming up on the left side of the plane is some of the destruction caused by the Purity War, before the rebels resorted to biological warfare instead of explosives, Zoe says. I have to blink tears from my eyes before I can see it. What looks at first to be a group of dark buildings. Upon further examination, I realize that the buildings aren't supposed to be dark. They're charred beyond recognition. Some of them are flattened. The pavement between them is broken in pieces like a cracked eggshell. It resembles certain parts of the city. But at the same time, it doesn't. The city's destruction could have been caused by people. This had to have been caused by something else, something bigger. And now, you'll get a brief look at Chicago, Zoe says. You'll see that some of the lake was drained so that we could build the fence, but we left as much of it intact as possible. At her words, I see the two-pronged hub, as small as a toy in the distance, the jagged line of our city interrupting the sea of concrete, and beyond it, a brown expanse, the marsh, and just past that, blue. Once I slid down a zip line from the Hancock building and imagined what the marsh looked like full of water, blue, gray, and gleaming under the sun. And now that I can see farther than I've ever seen, I know that far beyond our city's limits, it is just like what I imagined. The lake in the distance glinting with streaks of light, marked with the texture of waves. The plane is silent around me, except for the steady roar of the engine.
Whoa, says Uriah.
Shh, Christina replies.
How big is it compared to the rest of the world? Peter says from across the plane. He sounds like he's choking on each word.
Our city, I mean. In terms of land area, what percentage?
Chicago takes up about 227 square miles,
says Zoe. The land area of the planet is a little less than 200 million square miles. The percentage is so small as to be negligible. She delivers the facts calmly, as if they mean nothing to her. But they hit me square in the stomach, and I feel squeezed, like something is crushing me into myself. So much space. I wonder what it's like in the places beyond ours. I wonder how people live there. I look out the window again, taking slow, deep breaths into a body too tense to move. And as I stare out at the land, I think that this, if nothing else, is compelling evidence for my parents' God, that our world is so massive that it is completely out of our control, that we cannot possibly be as large as we feel, so small as to be negligible. It's strange, but there's something in that thought that makes me feel almost free. That evening, when everyone else is at dinner, I sit on the window ledge in the dormitory and turn on the screen David gave me. My hands tremble as I open the file labeled Journal. The first entry reads, David keeps asking me to write down what I experienced. I think he expects it to be horrifying, maybe even wants it to be. I guess parts of it were, but they were bad for everyone, so it's not like I'm special. I grew up in a single-family home in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I never knew much about who was inside the territory outside the city, which everyone around here calls the fringe. Just that I wasn't supposed to go there. My mom was in law enforcement. She was explosive and impossible to please. My dad was a teacher. He was pliable and supportive and useless. One day, they got into it in the living room, and things got out of hand, and he grabbed her, and she shot him. That night she was burying his body in the backyard while I assembled a good portion of my possessions and left through the front door. I never saw her again. Where I grew up, tragedy is all over the place. Most of my friends' parents drank themselves stupid, or yelled too much, or had stopped loving each other a long time ago, and that was just the way of things. No big deal. So when I left, I'm sure I was just another item on a long list of awful things that had happened in our neighborhood in the past year. I knew that if I went any place official, like to another city, the government types would just make me go home to my mom. And I didn't think I would ever be able to look at her without seeing the streak of blood my dad's head left on the living room carpet. So I didn't go any place official. I went to the fringe, where a whole bunch of people are living in a little colony made of tarp and aluminum and some of the post-war wreckage, living on scraps and burning old papers for warmth because the government can't provide, since they're spending all their resources trying to put us back together again, and have been for over a century after the war ripped us apart. Or they won't provide. I don't know. One day, I saw a grown man beating up one of the kids in the fringe, and I hit him over the head with a plank to get him to stop, and he died. Right there in the street. I was only 13. I ran. I got snatched by some guy in a van, some guy who looked like police, but he didn't take me to the side of the road to shoot me, and he didn't take me to jail. He just took me to the secure area and tested my genes and told me all about the city experiments and how my genes were cleaner than other people's. He even showed me a map of my genes on a screen to prove it. But I killed a man. Just like my mother did. David says it's okay because I didn't mean to, and because he was about to kill that little kid. But I'm pretty sure my mom didn't mean to kill my dad either. So what difference does that make? Meaning or not meaning to do something? Accident or on purpose? The result is the same. And that's one fewer life than there should be in the world. That's what I experienced, I guess. And to hear David talk about it, It's like it all happened because a long, long time ago, people tried to mess with human nature and ended up making it worse. I guess that makes sense. Or I'd like it to. My teeth dig into my lower lip. Here in the Bureau compound, people are sitting in the cafeteria right now, eating and drinking and laughing. In the city, they're probably doing the same thing. Ordinary life surrounds me, and I am alone with these revelations. I clutch the screen to my chest. My mother was from here. This place is both my ancient and my recent history. I can feel her in the walls, in the air. I can feel her settled inside me, never to leave again. Death could not erase her. She is permanent. The cold from the glass seeps through my shirt, and I shiver. Uriah and Christina walk through the door to the dormitory, laughing about something. Uriah's clear eyes and steady footsteps fill me with a sense of relief, and my eyes well up with tears all of a sudden. He and Christina both look alarmed, and they lean against the windows on either side of me. "You okay?" she says. I nod and blink the tears away. "Where have you guys been today?" "After the plane ride, we went and watched the screens in the control room for a while," Uriah says. "It's really weird to see what they're up to now that we're gone. Just more of the same. Evelyn's a jerk. So are all her lackeys. And so on. But it was like getting a news report." "I don't think I'd like to look at those," I say. "Too creepy and invasive." Uriah shrugs. "I don't know. If they want to watch me scratch my butt or eat dinner, I feel like that says more about them than about me." I laugh. "How often are you scratching your butt exactly?" He jostles me with his elbow. "Not to derail the conversation from butts, which we can all agree is incredibly important." Christina smiles a little. "But I'm with you, Tress. Just watching those screens made me feel awful, like I was doing something sneaky. I think I'll be staying away from now on." She points to the screen in my lap, where the light still glows around my mother's words. "What's that?" "As it turns out," I say, "my mother was from here. Well, she was from the world outside, but then she came here, and when she was 15, she was placed in Chicago as a Dauntless." Christina says, "Your mother was from here?" I nod. "Yeah, insane. Even weirder, she wrote this journal and left it with them. That's what I was reading before you came in." "Wow," Christina says softly. "That's good, right? I mean, that you get to learn more about her." "Yeah, it's good. And no, I'm not still upset. You can stop looking at me like that." The look of concern that had been building on Uriah's face disappears. I sigh. "I just keep thinking that in some way, I belong here. Like, maybe this place can be home." Christina pinches her eyebrows together. "Maybe," she says, and I feel like she doesn't believe it. But it's nice of her to say it anyway. "I don't know," Uriah says, and he sounds serious now. "I'm not sure anywhere will feel like home again. Not even if we went back." "Maybe that's true. Maybe we're strangers no matter where we go. Whether it's to the world outside the Bureau, or here in the Bureau, or back in the experiment. Everything has changed, and it won't stop changing anytime soon. Or maybe we'll make a home somewhere inside ourselves, to carry with us wherever we go. Which is the way I carry my mother now." Caleb walks into the dormitory. There's a stain on his shirt that looks like sauce, but he doesn't seem to notice it. He has the look in his eye that I now recognize as intellectual fascination, and for a moment, I wonder what he's been reading or watching to make him look that way. "Hi," he says, and he almost makes a move toward me. But he must see my revulsion, because he stops in the middle of a step. I cover the screen with my palm, though he can't see it from across the room, and stare at him, unable,
or unwilling, to say anything in reply.
You think you'll ever speak to me again? He says, sadly, his mouth turning down at the corners.
If she does, I'll die of shock, Christina says coldly.
I look away. The truth is, sometimes I want to just forget about everything that's happened and return to the way we were before either of us chose a faction. Even if he was always correcting me, reminding me to be selfless, it was better than this. This feeling that I need to protect even my mother's journal from him, so that he can't poison it like he's done to everything else. I get up and slip it under my pillow.
Come on, Uriah says to me. Want to go with us to get some dessert?
You didn't already have some?
So what if I did?
Uriah rolls his eyes and puts his arm across my shoulders, steering me toward the door.
Together, the three of us walk toward the cafeteria, leaving my brother behind.
Chapter 20. Tobias. Wasn't sure if you would come, Nita says to me. When she turns to lead me wherever we're going, I see that her loose shirt is low in the back and there's a tattoo on her spine, but I can't make out what it is. You get tattoos too here? I say. Some people do, she says. The one on my back is of broken glass. She pauses. The kind of pause you take when you're deciding whether or not to share something personal. I got it because it suggests damage. It's sort of a joke. There's that word again. Damage. The one that's been sinking and surfacing in my mind since the genetic test. If it's a joke, it's not a funny one, even for Nita. She spits out the explanation like it tastes bitter to her. We walk down one of the tiled corridors, nearly empty now at the end of a workday, and down a flight of stairs. As we descend, blue and green and purple and red lights dance over the walls, shifting between colors with each second. The tunnel at the bottom of the stairs is wide and dark, with only the strange light to guide us. The floor here is old tile, and even through my shoe soles it feels grainy with dirt and dust. This part of the airport was completely redone and expanded when they first moved in here, Nita says. For a while, after the Purity War, all the laboratories were underground to keep them safer if they were attacked. Now it's just the support staff who goes down here. Is that who you want me to meet? She nods. Support staff is more than just a job. Almost all of us are GDs, genetically damaged. Leftovers from the failed city experiments, or the descendants of other leftovers, or people pulled in from the outside, like Triss's mother, except without her genetic advantage. And all of the scientists and leaders are GPs, genetically pure, descendants of people who resisted the genetic engineering movement in the first place. There are some exceptions, of course, but so few I could list them all for you if I wanted to. I am about to ask why the division is so strict, but I can figure it out for myself. The so-called GPs grew up in this community, their worlds saturated by experiments and observation and learning. The GDs grew up in the experiments, where they only had to learn enough to survive until the next generation. The division is based on knowledge, based on qualifications, but as I learned from the factionless, a system that relies on a group of uneducated people to do its dirty work without giving them a way to rise is hardly fair. I think your girl's right, you know, Nita says. Nothing has changed. Now you just have a better idea of your own limitations. Every human being has limitations, even GPs. So there's an upward limit to... What? My compassion? My conscience? I say. That's the reassurance you have for me? Nita's eyes study me carefully and she doesn't respond. This is ridiculous, I say. Why do you or they or anyone get to determine my limits? It's just the way things are, Tobias, Nita says. It's just genetic. Nothing more. That's a lie, I say. It's about more than genes here, and you know it. I feel like I need to leave. To turn and run back to the dormitory. The anger is boiling and churning inside me, filling me with heat, and I'm not even sure who it's for. For Nita?
who has just accepted that she is somehow limited? Or for whoever told her that? Maybe it's for everyone. We reach the end of the tunnel, and she nudges a heavy wooden door open with her shoulder. Beyond it is a bustling, glowing world. The room is lit by small, bright bulbs on strings, but the strings are so densely packed that a web of yellow and white covers the ceiling. On one end of the room is a wooden counter with glowing bottles behind it and a sea of glasses on top of it. There are tables and chairs on the left side of the room and a group of people with musical instruments on the right side. Music fills the air, and the only sounds I recognize from my limited experience with the Amity are plucked guitar strings and drums. I feel like I am standing beneath a spotlight and everyone is watching me, waiting for me to move, speak, something. For a moment, it's hard to hear anything over the music and the chatter, but after a few seconds I get used to it, and I hear Nita when she says, "This way. Want a drink?" I'm about to answer when someone runs into the room. He's short, and the t-shirt he wears hangs from his body, two sizes too large for him. He gestures for the musicians to stop playing, and they do, just long enough for him to shout, "It's verdict time!" Half the room gets up and rushes toward the door. I give Nita a questioning look, and she frowns, creating a crease in her forehead. "Whose verdict?" I say. "Marcus's, no doubt," she replies. And I'm running. I sprint back down the tunnel, finding the open spaces between people and pushing my way through if there are none. Nita runs at my heels, shouting for me to stop, but I can't stop. I am separate from this place and these people and my own body, and besides, I have always been a good runner. I take the stairs three at a time, clutching the railing for balance. I don't know what I am so eager for. Marcus's conviction? His exoneration? Do I hope that Evelyn finds him guilty and executes him, or do I hope that she spares him? I can't tell. To me, each outcome feels like it's made of the same substance. Everything is either Marcus's evil or Marcus's mask, Evelyn's evil or Evelyn's mask. I don't have to remember where the control room is because the people in the hallway lead me to it. When I reach it, I push my way to the front of the crowd, and there they are, my parents, shown on half the screens. Everyone moves away from me, whispering, except Nita, who stands beside me, catching her breath. Someone turns up the volume so we can all hear their voices. They crackle, distorted by the microphones, but I know my father's voice. I can hear it shift at all the right times, lift in all the right places. I can almost predict his words before he says them. "You took your time," he says, sneering. "Savoring the moment?" I stiffen. This is not Marcus's mask. This is not the person who the city knows as my father, the patient, calm leader of abnegation who would never hurt anyone, least of all his own son or wife. This is the man who slid his belt out loop by loop and wrapped it around his knuckles. This is the Marcus I know best. And the sight of him, like the sight of him in my fear landscape, turns me into a child. "Of course not, Marcus," my mother says. "You have served this city well for many years. This is not a decision I or any of my advisors have taken lightly." Marcus is not wearing his mask, but Evelyn is wearing hers. She sounds so genuine she almost convinces me. "I and the former representatives of the faction have had a lot to consider. Your years of service, the loyalty you have inspired among your faction members, my lingering feelings for you as my former husband." I snort. "I am still your husband," Marcus says. "The abnegation do not allow divorce."
"They do in cases of spousal abuse," Evelyn replies.
And I feel that same old feeling again. The hollowness and the weight. I can't believe she just admitted that in public. But then, she now wants the people in the city to see her a certain way. Not as the heartless woman who took control of their lives, but as the woman Marcus attacked with his might. The secret he hid behind a clean house and pressed gray clothing. I know then what the outcome of this will be.
"She's going to kill him," I say.
The fact remains, says Evelyn, almost sweetly, that you have committed egregious crimes against this city. You deceived innocent children into risking their lives for your purposes. Your refusal to follow the orders of myself and Tori Wu, the former leader of Dauntless, resulted in countless deaths in the erudite attack. You betrayed your peers by failing to do as we agreed and by failing to fight against Janine Matthews. You betrayed your own faction by revealing what was supposed to be a guarded secret. I did not. I am not finished, Evelyn says. Given your record of service to this city, we have decided on an alternate solution. You will not, unlike the other former faction representatives, be forgiven and allowed to consult on issues regarding this city. Nor will you be executed as a traitor. Instead, you will be sent outside the fence, beyond the Amity compound, and you will not be allowed to return. Marcus looks surprised. I don't blame him. Congratulations, says Evelyn. You have the privilege of beginning again. Should I feel relieved that my father isn't going to be executed? Angry that I came so close to finally escaping him, but instead he'll still be in this world, still hanging over my head? I don't know. I don't feel anything. My hands go numb, so I know I'm panicking, but I don't really feel it. Not the way I normally do. I am overwhelmed with the need to be somewhere else, so I turn and leave my parents and Nita and the city where I once lived behind me.
Chapter 21. Triss. They announce the attack drill in the morning over the intercom as we eat breakfast. The crisp female voice instructs us to lock the door to whatever room we are in from the inside, cover the windows, and sit quietly until the alarms no longer sound. It will take place at the top of the hour, she says. Tobias looks worn and pale, with dark circles under his eyes. He picks at a muffin, pinching small pieces off and sometimes eating them, sometimes forgetting to. Most of us woke up late, at 10, I suspect because there was no reason not to. When we left the city, we lost our factions, our sense of purpose. Here, there is nothing to do but wait for something to happen. And far from making me feel relaxed, it makes me feel jittery and tense. I'm used to having something to do, something to fight, all the time. I try to remind myself to relax. They took us up in a plane yesterday, I say to Tobias. Where were you?
I just had to walk around, process things.
He sounds terse, irritated.
How was it?
Amazing, actually. I sit across from him so that our knees touch in the space between our beds. The world is a lot bigger than I thought it was.
He nods. I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it, heights and all.
I don't know why, but his reaction disappoints me. I want him to say that he wishes he had been there with me, to experience it with me, or at least to ask me what I mean when I say that it was amazing. But all he can say is that he wouldn't have liked it. Are you all right? I say. You look like you barely slept.
Well, yesterday carried quite the revelation, he says, putting his forehead into his hand. You can't really blame me for being upset about it.
I mean, you can be upset about whatever you want, I say, frowning. But from my perspective, it doesn't seem like there's much to be upset about. I know it's a shock, but as I said, you're still the same person you were yesterday and the day before, no matter what these people say about it. He shakes his head. I'm not talking about my genes. I'm talking about Marcus. You really have no idea, do you? The question is accusatory, but his tone isn't. He gets up to toss his muffin in the trash. I feel raw and frustrated. Of course I knew about Marcus. It was buzzing around the room when I woke up. But for some reason,
I didn't think it would upset him to know his father wasn't going to be executed. Apparently, I was wrong. It doesn't help that the alarms sound at that exact moment, preventing me from saying anything else to him. They are loud, screeching, so painful to listen to that I can barely think, let alone move. I keep one hand clamped over my ear and slide my other hand under my pillow to pick up the screen with my mother's journal on it. Tobias locks the door and draws the curtains closed, and everyone sits on their cots. Kara wraps a pillow around her head. Peter just sits with his back against the wall, his eyes closed. I don't know where Caleb is, researching whatever made him so distant yesterday, probably. Or where Christina and Uriah are, exploring the compound, maybe. Yesterday, after dessert, they seemed determined to discover every corner of the place. I decided to discover my mother's thoughts about it instead. She wrote several entries about her first impressions of the compound, the strange cleanliness of the place, how everyone smiled all the time, how she fell in love with the city by watching it in the control room. I turn on the screen, hoping to distract myself from the noise. Today, I volunteered to go inside the city. David said the Divergent are dying, and someone has to stop it, because that's a waste of our best genetic material. I think that's a pretty sick way to put it, but David doesn't mean it that way. He just means that if it wasn't the Divergent dying, we wouldn't intervene until a certain level of destruction. But since it's them, it has to be taken care of now. Just a few years, he said. All I have here are a few friends, no family, and I'm young enough that it will be easy to insert me. Just wipe and resupply a few people's memories, and I'm in. They'll put me in Dauntless at first, because I already have tattoos, and that would be hard to explain to the people inside the experiment. The only problem is that at my choosing ceremony next year, I'll have to join Erudite, because that's where the killer is, and I'm not sure I'm smart enough to make it through initiation. David says it doesn't matter. He can alter my results. But that feels wrong. Even if the Bureau thinks the factions don't mean anything, that they're just a kind of behavioral modification that will help with the damage, those people believe they do. And it feels wrong to play with their system. I've been watching them for a couple years now, so there's not much I need to know about fitting in. I bet I know the city better than they do at this point. It's going to be difficult to send my updates. Someone might notice that I'm connecting to a distant server instead of an intra-city server. So my entries will probably come less often, if at all. It will be hard to separate myself from everything I know. But maybe it will be good. Maybe it will be a fresh start. I could really use one of those. It's a lot to take in, but I find myself rereading the sentence. The only problem is that at my choosing ceremony next year, I'll have to join Erudite, because that's where the killer is. I don't know what killer she's referring to. Janine Matthews' predecessor, maybe? But more confusing even than that is that she didn't join Erudite. What happened to make her join Abnegation instead? The alarms stop, and my ears feel muffled in their absence. The others trickle out slowly, but Tobias lingers for a moment, tapping his fingers against his leg. I don't speak to him. I'm not sure I want to hear what he has to say right now, when we're both on edge. But all he says is, "Can I kiss you?" "Yes," I say, relieved. He bends down and touches my cheek, then kisses me softly. Well, he knows how to improve my mood at least. "I didn't think about Marcus. I should have," I say. He shrugs. "It's over now." I know it's not over. It's never over with Marcus. The wrongs he committed are too great. But I don't press the issue. "More journal entries?" he says. "Yes," I say. Just some memories of the compound so far, but it's getting interesting.
Good, he says. I'll leave you with it.
He smiles a little, but I can tell he's still tired, still upset. I don't try to stop him from going. In a way, it feels like we are leaving each other to our grief. His over the loss of his divergence and whatever hopes he had for Marcus's trial, and mine, finally, over the loss of my parents. I tap the screen to read the next entry. Dear David. I raise my eyebrows. Now she's writing to David? Dear David. I'm sorry, but it's not going to happen the way we planned it. I can't do it. I know you're just going to think I'm being a stupid teenager, but this is my life, and if I'm going to be here for years, I have to do this my way. I'll still be able to do my job from outside of Erudite. So tomorrow, at the choosing ceremony, Andrew and I are going to choose abnegation together. I hope you're not angry. I guess even if you are, I won't hear about it. Natalie. I read the entry again, and again, letting the words sink in. Andrew and I are going to choose abnegation together. I smile into my hand, lean my head against the window, and let the tears fall in silence. My parents did love each other. Enough to forsake plans and factions. Enough to defy faction before blood. Blood before faction. No. Love before faction. Always. I turn off the screen. I don't want to read anything that will spoil this feeling. That I am adrift in calm waters. It's strange how, even though I should be grieving, I feel like I am actually getting back pieces of her, word by word, line by line. Chapter 22. Triss. There are only a dozen more entries in the file, and they don't tell me everything I want to know, though they do give me more questions. And instead of just containing her thoughts and impressions, they are all written to someone. Dear David, I thought you were more my friend than my supervisor, but I guess I was wrong. What did you think would happen when I came in here? That I would live single and alone forever? That I wouldn't get attached to anyone? That I wouldn't make any of my own choices? I left everything behind to come in here when no one else wanted to. You should be thanking me, instead of accusing me of losing sight of my mission. Let's get this straight. I'm not going to forget why I'm here, just because I chose abnegation, and I'm going to get married. I deserve to have a life of my own, one that I choose, not one that you and the Bureau choose for me. You should know all about that. You should understand why this life would appeal to me after all I've seen and been through. Honestly, I don't really think you care that I didn't choose Erudite like I was supposed to. It sounds like you're actually just jealous. And if you want me to keep updating you, you'll apologize for doubting me. But if you don't, I won't send you any more updates, and I certainly won't leave the city to visit anymore. It's up to you. Natalie. I wonder if she was right about David. The thought itches at my mind. Was he really jealous of my father? Did his jealousy fade over time? I can only see their relationship from her eyes, and I'm not sure she's the most accurate source of information about it. I can tell she's getting older in the entries, her language becoming more refined as time separates her from the fringe where she once lived, her reactions becoming more moderate. She's growing up. I check the date on the next entry. It's a few months later, but it's not addressed to David the way some of the others have been. The tone is different, too. Not as familiar, more straightforward. I tap the screen, flipping through the entries. It takes me 10 taps to reach an entry that is addressed to David again. The date on the entry suggests that it came a full 2 years later.
Dear David, I got your letter. I understand why you can't be on the receiving end of these updates anymore, and I'll respect your decision. But I'll miss you. I wish you every happiness. Natalie. I try to flip forward, but the journal entries are over. The last document in the file is a certificate of death. The cause of death says, multiple gunshot wounds to the torso. I rock back and forth a little, to dispel the image of her collapsing in the street from my mind. I don't want to think about her death. I want to know more about her, and my father, and her and David. Anything to distract me from the way her life ended. It's a sign of how desperate I am for information, and action, that I go to the control room with Zoe later that morning. She talks to the manager of the control room about a meeting with David as I stare, determined, at my feet, not wanting to see what's on the screens. I feel like if I allow myself to look at them, even for a moment, I will become addicted to them, lost in the old world, because I don't know how to navigate this new one. As Zoe finishes her conversation, though, I can't keep my curiosity in check. I look at the large screen hanging over the desks. Evelyn is sitting on her bed, running her hands over something on her bedside table. I move closer to see what it is, and the woman at the desk in front of me says, "This is the Evelyn cam. We track her 24/7. "Can you hear her?" "Only if we turn the volume up," the woman replies. "We mostly keep the sound off, though. Hard to listen to that much chatter all day." I nod. "What is that she's touching?" "Some kind of sculpture, I don't know," the woman shrugs. "She stares at it a lot, though." I recognize it from somewhere. From Tobias's room, where I slept after my almost execution in Erudite headquarters. It's made of blue glass, an abstract shape that looks like falling water frozen in time. I touch my fingertips to my chin as I search my memory. He told me that Evelyn gave it to him when he was young, and instructed him to hide it from his father, who wouldn't approve of a useless but beautiful object, abnegation that he was. I didn't think much of it at the time, but it must mean something to her, if she carried it all the way from the abnegation sector to Erudite headquarters to keep on her bedside table. Maybe it was her way of rebelling against the faction system. On the screen, Evelyn balances her chin on her hand and stares at the sculpture for a moment. Then she gets up and shakes out her hands and leaves the room. No, I don't think the sculpture is a sign of rebellion. I think it's just a reminder of Tobias. Somehow, I never realized that when Tobias charged out of the city with me, he wasn't just a rebel defying his leader. He was a son abandoning his mother, and she is grieving over it. Is he? Fraught with difficulty as their relationship has been, those ties never really break. They can't possibly. Zoe touches my shoulder. "You wanted to ask me something?" I nod and turn away from the screens. Zoe was young in the photograph where she stood next to my mother, but she was still there, so I figure she must know something. I would have asked David, but as the leader of the Bureau, he is difficult to find. "I wanted to know about my parents," I say. I'm reading her journal, and I guess I'm having a hard time figuring out how they even met, or why they joined abnegation together. Zoe nods slowly. "I'll tell you what I know. Mind walking with me to the labs? I need to leave a message with Matthew." She holds her hands behind her back, resting them at the bottom of her spine. I am still holding the screen David gave me. It's marked all over with my fingerprints, and warm from my constant touch. I understand why Evelyn keeps touching that sculpture. It's the last piece of her son she has. Just like this is the last piece of my mother that I have. I feel closer to her when it's with me. I think that's why I can't give it to Caleb, even though he has a right to see it. I'm not sure I can let go of it yet.
They met in a class, Zoe says. Your father, though a very smart man, never quite got the knack of psychology. And the teacher, an erudite, unsurprisingly, was very hard on him for it. So your mother offered to help him after school. And he told his parents he was doing some kind of school project. They did this for several weeks, and then started to meet in secret. I think one of their favorite places was the fountain south of Millennium Park. Buckingham Fountain? Right by the marsh? I imagine my mother and father sitting beside a fountain, under the spray of water, their feet skimming the concrete bottom. I know the fountain Zoe is referring to hasn't been operational for a long time, so the spraying water was never there. But the picture is prettier that way. The choosing ceremony was approaching, and your father was eager to leave erudite because he saw something terrible. What? What did he see? Well, your father was a good friend of Janine Matthews, says Zoe. He saw her performing an experiment on a factionless man in exchange for something, food or clothing, something like that. Anyway, she was testing the fear-inducing serum that was later incorporated into Dauntless Initiation. Long ago, the fear simulations weren't generated by a person's individual fears, you see. Just general fears, like heights or spiders or something. And Norton, then the representative of erudite, was there, letting it go on for far longer than it should have. The factionless man was never quite right again. And that was the last straw for your father. She pauses in front of the door to the labs to open it with her ID badge. We walk into the dingy office where David gave me my mother's journal. Matthew is sitting with his nose 3 inches from his computer screen, his eyes narrow. He barely registers our presence when we walk in. I feel overwhelmed by the desire to smile and cry at the same time. I sit down in the chair next to the empty desk, my hands clasped between my knees. My father was a difficult man, but he was also a good one. Your father wanted out of erudite, and your mother didn't want in, no matter what her mission was. But she still wanted to be near Andrew, so they chose abnegation together. She pauses. This caused a rift between your mother and David, as I'm sure you saw. He eventually apologized, but said he couldn't receive updates from her anymore. I don't know why. He wouldn't say. And after that, her reports were very short, very informational, which is why they're not in that journal. But she was still able to carry out her mission in abnegation. Yes, and she was much happier there, I think, than she would have been among the erudite. Zoe says, of course, abnegation turned out to be no better, in some ways. It seems there's no escaping the reach of genetic damage. Even the abnegation leadership was poisoned by it. I frown. Are you talking about Marcus? Because he's divergent. Genetic damage had nothing to do with it. A man surrounded by genetic damage cannot help but mimic it with his own behavior, Zoe says. Matthew, David wants to set up a meeting with your supervisor to discuss one of the serum developments. Last time, Alan completely forgot about it, so I was wondering if you could escort him. Sure, Matthew says without looking away from his computer. I'll get him to give me a time. Lovely. Well, I have to go. I hope that answered your question, Triss. She smiles at me and slips out the door. I sit hunched, with my elbows on my knees. Marcus was divergent, genetically pure, just like me. But I don't accept that he was a bad person because he was surrounded by genetically damaged people. So was I. So was Uriah. So was my mother. But none of us lashed out at our loved ones. Her argument has a few holes in it, doesn't it? Says Matthew. He's watching me from behind his desk, tapping his fingers on the arm of his chair. Yeah, I say. Some of the people here want to blame genetic damage for everything, he says. It's easier for them to accept than the truth, which is that they can't know everything about people and why they act the way they do.
Everyone has to blame something for the way the world is, I say. For my father, it was the erudite. I probably shouldn't tell you that the erudite were always my favorite then, Matthew says, smiling a little. Really? I straighten. Why? I don't know. I guess I agree with them. That if everyone would just keep learning about the world around them, they would have far fewer problems. I've been wary of them my whole life, I say, resting my chin on my hand. My father hated the erudite, so I learned to hate them too, and everything they did with their time. Only now, I'm thinking he was wrong. Or just biased. About the erudite or about learning? I shrug. Both? So many of the erudite helped me when I didn't ask them to. Will, Fernando, Kara, all erudite, all some of the best people I've known, however briefly. They were so focused on making the world a better place. I shake my head. What Janine did has nothing to do with a thirst for knowledge, leading to a thirst for power, like my father told me, and everything to do with her being terrified of how big the world is and how powerless that made her. Maybe it was the Dauntless who had it right. There's an old phrase, Matthew says. Knowledge is power. Power to do evil, like Janine. Or power to do good, like what we're doing. Power itself is not evil. So knowledge itself is not evil. I guess I grew up suspicious of both. Power and knowledge, I say. To the abnegation, power should only be given to people who don't want it. There's something to that, Matthew says, but maybe it's time to grow out of that suspicion. He reaches under the desk and takes out a book. It is thick, with a worn cover and frayed edges. On it is printed, Human Biology. It's a little rudimentary, but this book helped to teach me what it is to be human, he says. To be such a complicated, mysterious piece of biological machinery, and more amazing still, to have the capacity to analyze that machinery. That is a special thing, unprecedented in all of evolutionary history. Our ability to know about ourselves and the world is what makes us human. He hands me the book and turns back to the computer. I look down at the worn cover and run my fingers along the edge of the pages. He makes the acquisition of knowledge feel like a secret, beautiful thing, and an ancient thing. I feel like if I read this book, I can reach backward through all the generations of humanity to the very first one, whenever it was, that I can participate in something many times larger and older than myself. Thank you, I say, and it's not for the book. It's for giving something back to me, something I lost before I was able to really have it. The lobby of the hotel smells like candied lemon and bleach, an acrid combination that burns my nostrils when I breathe it in. I walk past a potted plant with a garish flower blossoming among its branches, and toward the dormitory that has become our temporary home here. As I walk, I wipe the screen with the hem of my shirt, trying to get rid of some of my fingerprints. Caleb is alone in the dormitory, his hair tousled and his eyes red from sleep. He blinks at me when I walk in and toss the biology book onto my bed. I feel a sickening ache in my stomach and press the screen with our mother's file against my side. He's her son. He has a right to read her journal, just like you. If you have something to say, he says, just say it. Mom lived here. I blurt it out like a long-held secret, too loud and too fast. She came from the fringe. And they brought her here, and she lived here for a couple of years, then went into the city to stop the erudite from killing the divergent. Caleb blinks at me. Before I lose my nerve, I hold out the screen for him to take. Her file is here. It's not very long, but you should read it. He gets up and closes his hand around the glass. He's so much taller than he used to be, so much taller than I am.
For a few years when we were children, I was the taller one, even though I was almost a year younger. Those were some of our best years, the ones where I didn't feel like he was bigger or better or smarter or more selfless than I was.
How long have you known this? He says, narrowing his eyes.
It doesn't matter. I step back. I'm telling you now. You can keep that, by the way. I'm done with it. He wipes the screen with his sleeve and navigates with deft fingers to our mother's first journal entry. I expect him to sit down and read it, thus ending the conversation, but instead he sighs.
I have something to show you too, he says, about Edith Pryor. Come on.
It's her name, not my lingering attachment to him that draws me after him when he starts to walk away. He leads me out of the dormitory, and down the hallway, and around corners to a room far away from any that I have seen in the bureau compound. It is long and narrow, the walls covered with shelves that bear identical blue-gray books, thick and heavy as dictionaries. Between the first two rows is a long wooden table, with chairs tucked beneath it. Caleb flips the light switch, and pale light fills the room, reminding me of erudite headquarters.
I've been spending a lot of time here, he says. It's the record room. They keep some of the Chicago experiment data in here.
He walks along the shelves on the right side of the room, running his fingers over the book spines. He pulls out one of the volumes and lays it flat on the table, so it spills open, its pages covered in text and pictures.
Why don't they keep all this on computers?
I assume they kept these records before they developed a sophisticated security system on their network, he says without looking up. Data never fully disappears, but paper can be destroyed forever, so you can actually get rid of it if you don't want the wrong people to get their hands on it. It's safer sometimes to have everything printed out. His green eyes shift back and forth as he searches for the right place, his fingers nimble, built for turning pages. I think of how he disguised that part of himself, wedging books between his headboard and the wall in our abnegation house, until he dropped his blood in the erudite water on the day of our choosing ceremony. I should have known then that he was a liar, with loyalty only to himself. I feel that sickening ache again. I can hardly stand to be in here with him, the door closing us in, nothing but the table between us. Ah, here. He touches his finger to a page, then spins the book around to show me. It looks like a copy of a contract, but it's handwritten, in ink. I, Amanda Marie Ritter, of Peoria, Illinois, give my consent to the following procedures. The genetic healing procedure, as defined by the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. A genetic engineering procedure designed to correct the genes specified as damaged on page 3 of this form. The reset procedure, as defined by the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. A memory erasing procedure designed to make an experiment participant more fit for the experiment. I declare that I have been thoroughly instructed as to the risks and benefits of these procedures by a member of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. I understand that this means I will be given a new background and a new identity by the Bureau and inserted into the experiment in Chicago, Illinois,